All right, today it is December 24th, 2022, 1808 or 1808 hours, and my name is Ward Green. I'm pleased to be with you for our study again today. Let me just adjust my cam ever so slightly here. It's better, I think. It's been snowy, very snowy. Tomorrow is the day that we call Christmas Day, right? This is Christmas Eve Day. But we don't celebrate that holiday since it's not a Bible-based teaching. It has nothing to do with the Bible. So it's not necessary to celebrate that, but many people do celebrate that. However, Christians are not required at all to do anything. In fact, you know, I mean, there is a Bible principle that says that one man treats a day as more special, or one man regards a day as above or more important than the other days, and other men see the days as equal, you know. So, I mean, for me, all days are equally worth celebrating. But look at this scripture at Hebrews. I want to share the scripture at Hebrews 11:38. It says, "The world was not worthy of the prophets." The world was not worthy of them. That's a concept that explains why some people are underappreciated in the world, even though they might have very valuable teachings. For example, Lauren Lockman is very knowledgeable about fasting. The things that he teaches are completely, I shouldn't say completely true, but I mean, he's not any kind of scam artist or any kind of charlatan or any, there are no real inaccuracies in anything he's saying, unless he's making statements about you know, how the body works, which are speculative. Unless he's speculating, then everything he's saying is completely accurate. I mean, he's a trustworthy person, but so is everybody whom I present on my videos, in my videos. Everybody I present in my videos is trustworthy in terms of I've vetted them, I've found them to be reliable through my own efforts. For example, Dr. Cathcart, I've tried vitamin C because of him, partly because of him anyway, but because of more than him, I tried vitamin C as a treatment for infection, and I know it works, so that's why I present that information. And that's why I present Dr. Cathcart, because he's proven to be true. Everything I present is proven by me to be true. I've tried it and found it to be true, and that's why I present it. So today I want to present another interesting video by a gentleman by the name of Max Egorov. Let's make that wider. Let us try. Yes, we need to make this, miniaturize this window here. There we go. Let's see. There we are. Let's try that. So watch this video about, it's about how to remove a tick. How to remove a tick when you don't have a proper tick extractor. Max Egorov.
as it usually occurs when you need to extract a tick in the woods, it often happens to be where one is unlikely to find tweezers or factory-made tick removal tools. Using your fingers, you can only grasp a tick's body, which can cause its head to break off and remain in the skin. You need to pull a tick out by its chelicera and hypostome, which is usually referred to as the tick's mouth parts. The tick's barbed hypostome is a harpoon-shaped part of its mouth that almost fully inserts in the skin. Because it is impossible to pull a tick by its chelicera with just fingers, there are many types of tick extractor tools for sale. However, if you are in the woods and lack a factory-made tick extractor, you can easily make one using a knife and a piece of plastic. For example, you can use your credit card or a plastic bottle. All you have to do is to make a proper V-shaped cut with beveled edges. The main advantage of this tick extraction method is its reliability. Unlike some other tick removal methods, it allows to extract a tick using only one hand. To demonstrate how my plastic card extractor works, I decided to make a 1 to 40 scale model of a tick and extractor. Because the tick's body has an egg-shaped outline, I decided to cast an aluminum egg using a sand casting method. I poured molten aluminum into an empty eggshell nested in sand and used it as a mold. Then I polished the tick's model body and drilled a hole on one end. This hole was used to mount a piece of rope that will imitate the tick's chelicera and hypostome. Then, using two scrap pieces of plywood, I made a model of the plastic card extractor. You can now see the shape of the V-cut better. Both sides of it look like two chisel bevels that join at the top of the V-cut. This scrap board with a countersunk hole will imitate the human skin. The demo kit is ready, and I'm quite sure once you see the large-scale demonstration of the method, you'll be convinced that such credit card extractor can effectively remove ticks even if you have no experience at all. If you pull a tick by its body, it will just come off, leaving tick's chelicera and hypostome in the skin. But if you do it using an extractor, the tick's mouth parts will get wedged inside the extractor's V-cut, thus ensuring a full tick extraction. You can see that the rope is reliably wedged inside the model extractor's V-cut. This is what happens with the tick's mouth parts inside the credit card extractor's V-cut too. It is common knowledge that it is easier to pull out a metal nail while it still has a head. The same thing goes here. It is much easier to remove a whole tick, as extracting its torn mouth parts alone from flesh would be much harder. If you use a piece of plastic cut from a bottle, it is best to make a V-cut using a knife, keeping the same cut angle to ensure beveled edges of the cut. Using scissors is not recommended. I will be honest, I'm not afraid of ticks, although they are undoubtedly dangerous. This is the first tick that managed to bite me, as I always feel insects on my skin before they can bite me, but this time I missed it. I was cutting logs in the boards for my cabin's door, and the flying chips masked the feeling of the parasite's bite. This goes to show it is important to wear proper clothes in the woods at all times. You can see how careless I am in this footage, even though I already warded off almost a dozen ticks off me by this point of the project. Don't repeat my mistake. If you don't have tick repellent clothing that gives you almost 100% protection, tuck your shirt into your pants and your pants into your socks. This way, a tick would have to crawl up all the way to your collar, which reduces chances of getting bitten. Ticks are not dangerous because they suck blood, but because they are carriers of dangerous diseases, such as Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and others. Disclaimer. I don't consider myself to be an expert in infectious diseases or tick extraction. I only showed an impromptu method I came up with on the spot to remove a tick with what I had at my disposal in the woods. If you know about other reliable or original tick extraction methods, please let me know in the comment section. I would appreciate that. This is Max Yegorov from St. Petersburg, Russia. If you liked this video, perhaps you could share it with your friends. Let good people watch good videos.
That was Max Igorov. His channel is Advoco Makes on YouTube. Advoco Makes, that's his channel. And, Lyme disease is it's an infection, so it can be cured with vitamin C in the same way that all other infections are cured with vitamin C, at least except for AIDS or for a genetic infection that will continue to, it will remain in the DNA, of course, after, or no matter how long you treat using vitamin C, the genetic part of the AIDS will still be there in the body. So you can't cure AIDS with vitamin C, but you can remove all the symptoms of it. You can remove all of the symptoms of AIDS with vitamin C, but it requires a large amount in the case of AIDS. And in the case of other infections, they can be cured completely, and some require more vitamin C than others. But what vitamin C does is it eliminates the free radicals, and therefore the disease, virus or bacteria, perishes at some point during the destruction of these free radicals, which these viruses use in order to survive. So the free radical, we don't understand everything about how these things proliferate, how they survive, anything. We don't really understand all the intricacies of bacteria and virus species. However, viri, is it called? Viri, the plural of virus? We don't understand the details of how anything works in the human body, but we know from experience that vitamin C actually works. It kills all bacterial and viral infection, with the already noted exception of AIDS. But it works, and it's completely reliable, and it's completely harmless, as far as I'm aware, as far as I can tell. Even though you can get stomach pain if you eat too much vitamin C, because it can produce gas, and that's what I experienced that one day when I was having a large infection of some kind that enabled me to take ...24 grams one day, and then 36 grams the next day. But only on the day when I took 36 grams did I get gas. And the total amount that I took of vitamin C was 78 grams for that particular infection, which is the most I've ever taken for any infection. But people have taken more than a pound. Or I know of the example that Dr. Cathcart gives of the small 98-pound woman who took a pound of vitamin C in 48 hours without any complications. You know, just no problems. But her mononucleosis disappeared and was cured by doing that. But every infection can be treated with vitamin C. All flus, all colds. I've never had a cold since I've started using vitamin C in that way. It's done by taking a gram or two every 20 minutes, half an hour, or every hour, whatever you can take. And for smaller children, you can scale it down according to body weight, but even small children can be given vitamin C, and it can cure their whooping cough and all the measles, mumps, everything. All infections can be cured with the same method, which makes perfect sense that Jehovah would allow that to be true. I mean, it makes perfect sense that he wouldn't require all these complex, nonsensical, you know, treatments of using vaccination and all these things, which are completely bizarre. What a bizarre way to treat a disease, by giving somebody a sample of the disease, by infecting them with the disease in a less, albeit a less, harmful form, or less less virile form, but still these, less potentially harmful form. But it still is potentially harmful to take a vaccine, but not to mention the other things that are put in the vaccine besides the virus itself. which are harmful. So, I mean, vaccines are not the solution or the cure for disease in the form of infection. Vaccines are not the cure for infection. They're not needed at all for infection because vitamin C is the cure for infection. And it's taken in the form of a sorbate, simple ascorbate. 1 or 2 grams every 20 minutes is one way you could take it until you experience a loose stool or bowel movement, which is looser than normal, or until you know until you detect that is occurring, and then you can stop taking the vitamin C, or until the symptoms go away of the infection that you are developing. And as soon as the symptoms go away, you can stop taking the vitamin C. If the symptoms return, you can start taking it again. But as long as there are no symptoms, you're cured. And as you will get diarrhea if you keep taking vitamin C after the symptoms go away. But if you still have symptoms, you won't get diarrhea by taking vitamin C, because the vitamin C will be, the ascorbate, that is, which is vitamin C, the ascorbate will be used up in destroying the infection. It will not reach your bowel. And that's what happens, and that's what Dr. Cathcart discovered, and he was a pioneer of that treatment because he discovered that by stumbling onto it by accident. And it was a treatment that Linus Pauling, the Nobel Prize winner, believed himself. How he learned about it, I have no idea. Perhaps Dr. Cathcart learned about it because of Linus Pauling. I'm not sure why Dr. Cathcart first began his experiment, but his story is documented, and we'll talk about him later, I guess, some more. But these are examples of people. Perhaps we could say that this is true of them as well, that the world is not worthy of these people. They're just ignored. Even Linus Pauling, who believed in vitamin C, most people don't use that information. He believed in megadoses of vitamin C, what most people consider megadoses, large gram quantities instead of milligrams, instead of hundreds of milligrams. Instead of that, 1 or 2 or 3 or more grams of vitamin C, which is thousands of milligrams. That's the difference. And you don't need to take it every day. You can take it when you're sick with an infection type of illness. Any infection type of illness that you get that's typical of flu and cold and strep throat and other things you've had in the past, mumps, measles, anything that people have had that they can recognize as an infection. Any sore throat, for example, could be an infection. Or even allergies, though. It could actually be, because Dr. Cathcart used it and inadvertently made his allergies go away, his hay fever. So it can be used in the treatment of hay fever, and I've never used it for that purpose, not yet. I've not used it, but I will now that I've heard more from him. It's learning a little bit each day is how we make progress in some things, such as this, which is so poorly known in the mainstream. But the world is not worthy of the prophets. So to say that, to suspect everybody who's out there of being a liar because they don't conform to the mainstream would be obviously a bad thing to assume. For the director upon the gittis of the sons of Korah, a melody. This is short, as is Isaiah 64. How lovely your grand tabernacle is, O Jehovah of armies. My soul has yearned and also pined away for the courtyards of Jehovah. My own heart and my very flesh cry out joyfully to the living God. Technical difficulties are temporary, I believe. This is a temporary problem that we have here. There we go. How did that happen? There we go. It's not that big a problem, really. Back in place. I think we're back in business. Even the bird itself has found a house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she has put her young ones. your grand altar, O Jehovah of armies, my King and my God. She found the grand altar and put her nest there. Happy are those dwelling in your house. They still keep on praising you. Selah. Happy are the men whose strength is in you, in whose heart are the highways. Passing along through the low plain of the baca bushes, they turn it into a spring itself. Even with blessings, the instructor enwraps himself. They will walk on from vital energy to vital energy. Each one appears to God in Zion. O Jehovah, God of armies, do hear my prayer. Do give ear, O God of Jacob, Selah, O shield of ours, see, O God, and look upon the face of your anointed one. For a day in your courtyards is better than a thousand elsewhere. I have chosen to stand at the threshold in the house of my God, rather than to move around in the tents of wickedness. For Jehovah God is a sun and a shield. Favor and glory are what he gives. Jehovah himself will not hold back anything good from those walking in faultlessness. O Jehovah of armies, happy is the man that is trusting in you. Psalm 84, 12 verses. How lovely your grand tabernacle is, O Jehovah of armies. My soul has yearned and also pined away for the courtyards of Jehovah, the courtyards of Jehovah. The courtyards of Jehovah are his holy temple courtyards. And of course, this was written at the time of the sons of Korah, according to this, or their descendants, perhaps. But we know, because sons can mean grandsons and great grandsons and so on. And it can mean descendants, not ancestors, that's the opposite, but descendants. But even the bird has found a house and the swallow a nest for herself. And she did find it in the altar. She found the altar. She could make a nest in the altar. That's a beautiful story, isn't it? It's just like the kind of stories that grandparents tell to their grandchildren and things like that. Well, look upon the face of your anointed one. And for a day in your courtyards is better than a thousand days. It's amazing how important it is to spend time in the temple of Jehovah, even just in the courtyards, even without going into the temple itself. If we're not a priest, we can't go in there. But to stand, I mean, there is no temple nowadays. The temple was destroyed, but in those days, it would not have been possible to go into the temple, but a person could go into the courtyards. And even standing at the threshold of the house, but not going in because you weren't allowed, standing at the threshold would be preferable to this person who's writing this, rather than to move around in tents of wickedness. It's a beautiful, beautiful expression. And also look at this. Jehovah's a sun and shield, verse 11, and he will not hold anything back, anything good back from those walking in faultlessness. What a brilliant and encouraging promise that is made there by Jehovah in that psalm through that psalmist of the sons of Korah. Psalm 84, and Isaiah now 64, I believe, is the one. Little children, now let's try and absorb this information. Oh, if only you would rip the heavens apart, that you would come down, that on account of you the very mountains had quaked, as when a fire ignites the brushwood, and the fire makes the very water boil up. in order to make your name known to your adversaries, that on account of you the nations might be agitated. When did fear-inspiring things for which we could not hope, when you did fear-inspiring things for which we could not hope, you came down. On account of you, the mountains themselves quaked, and from time long ago none have heard, nor have any given ear, nor has an eye itself seen a God except you, that acts for the one that keeps in expectation of him. You have met up with the one exulting and doing righteousness. Those who keep remembering you in your own ways. Look, you yourself became indignant while we kept sinning in them a long time, and should we be saved? And we become like someone unclean, all of us, and all our acts of righteousness are like a garment for periods of menstruation, and we shall fade away like leafage, all of us, and our errors themselves will carry us away just like a wind. And there is no one calling upon your name, no one rousing himself to lay hold on you, for you have concealed your face from us, and you cause us to melt by the power of our error. And now, O Jehovah, you are our Father, we are the clay, and you are our potter, and all of us are the work of your hand. Do not be indignant, O Jehovah, to the extreme, and do not forever remember our error. Look now, please, we are all your people. Your own holy cities have become a wilderness. Zion itself has become a sheer wilderness. Jerusalem, a desolate waste. Our house of holiness and beauty, in which our forefathers praised you, has itself become something for burning in the fire. And every one of our desirable things has become a devastation. In the face of these things, will you continue keeping yourself in check, O Jehovah? Will you stay still and let us be afflicted to the extreme? So here again, well, first of all, verse 6, our righteousness, our acts of righteousness, are like a garment for periods of menstruation. In other words, they keep turning back to their sins, even when they do righteousness for a while. Then they turn back and do sin again, and they continue polluting their own righteousness using the sin, or by committing the sin repetitively. They keep sinning. But here it says, but the other day, the stamping down, when I looked in Strong's Concordance again, for that. Remember we looked that up? Let's see. I don't know how to find it. Let's see. Let's go. I'll try and find it separately here, so I won't have to show everything in my history here. Let's just see what we got. Let's try Bible Hub. There it is. Good. Okay. Right. So I'll just take that address. That's not what I want there. Stop it. Save the address. Copy it. And paste it here. Strong's Concordance. I missed this entry down here. Strong's Exhaustive Concordance. To trample, but it means to loathe figuratively. So our where it said our adversaries have trodden down your sanctuary. Our adversaries have trodden down your sanctuary, it says right here. Oops. or adversaries have trodden down your sanctuary, it says. But in Strong's exhaustive concordance, it says the figurative meaning is loathe. It can mean literally or figuratively. Loathe or tread down. Loathe or tread down. So it can mean to loathe. Our adversaries have loathed your sanctuary. That is one of the meanings of that word. So treading down doesn't mean it was literally destroyed at that time. But here it says, our house of holiness has become something for burning in the fire. Jerusalem has become a desolate waste. That's pretty strong. It raises the question, well, is it possible that these things that Isaiah is writing were written after the city of Jerusalem was actually destroyed? Is that possible? Well, it's interesting because when I first read the Bible and studied this, it never occurred to me that this had occurred after the destruction of Jerusalem. That never occurred to me, that thought. So, in Lamentations, of course, that was after Jerusalem was destroyed. There's no indication that here that Isaiah is talking about the city having been destroyed. Because here he's saying in verse 5, should we be saved? So he's implying that they had not been punished yet for their sin. Because he's saying our errors in verse 6 will carry us away. Not that the Hebrew verb has any future and past. The reason is, it's a prophecy. There is no future in Hebrew. There is no way to say in Hebrew that Jerusalem will be destroyed. There is no way to say that because there's no future in the Hebrew verb. There just isn't any. In Hebrew grammar, there's no future, there's no past, and there's no present in Hebrew. There isn't any. There's perfect and there's imperfect. In other words, you can say something is in the process of going on, or it's being done right now, or you can say it's been done in the past. It's perfect, perfected, or it's not perfect yet. Those are the only two verb tenses in Hebrew. There's no past or future. So to say that our city has become a desolate waste, that's a prophecy about the future, just as likely as it is a statement of something that's already occurred. And it's clear here that it's not talking about something that's already occurred because it's saying our errors will carry us away like a wind, as though it hasn't been destroyed yet. Their errors have not caught up with them yet. In this chapter of Isaiah. So that's the thing to understand about Hebrew, is it has no future or past tense in the verb. So here it says, and also it doesn't say that Jerusalem had been destroyed. It also didn't say that. It said it has become something for burning, but it didn't say it had been burnt. And then it also says it has become, Jerusalem has become a desolate waste. But that's a prophecy about the future because there is no such thing as past in Hebrew. It's a prophecy about the future because there isn't a past tense of the verb. So what could have been translated, it could have been translated as Zion will become a sheer wilderness and Jerusalem a desolate waste. That's what it could say. That would be equally accurate, maybe more accurate. That's not the way people have translated it. But that's maybe how it should be translated. Because Jerusalem had not been destroyed at that time, at the time of Isaiah. So that's important to understand. And always keep an open mind about these things, too. If later it should be proven that this book was, if it could be actually proven that the book was written or added to at a later date, and you know, if that were true, we should be open to it, but it's not the case. At present, we don't have that information. We have no evidence of that, and that's not something we should be thinking about because there is no present, past, or future in the Hebrew. Wait a minute. Hang on a second here. Yeah. That's right. So we're going to look at Matthew 14. It's fairly short, I think, this time. Quite short, quite a bit shorter than some of the chapters in Matthew. But still longer than either of these Psalm and Isaiah chapters of today. Of today's study. At that particular time, Herod, the district ruler, now this is not the same King Herod who died in 44, is it? Let me think. Well, there were a number of kings named Herod. Oh yeah, it's not clear if he's the same Herod who died in 44, just from this passage, we could find out, but because all the kings who were named Herod are documented in secular history, we know when they were ruling. In Jerusalem, we know from the secular history, the Roman records and all of these things give us information, but we know that he's not the Herod who died just after Jesus' birth in 4 BCE, BCE 4, which is the year that Herod died. That is a different Herod. He's an ancestor of these other Herods, or a relative at least, if not a direct ancestor, but he's a direct ancestor in some cases. So Herod heard the report about Jesus in this time period of Matthew 14, which was very close to the time of Jesus' baptism, or at least within a few years of that baptism, which occurred in, according to our own accurate chronology, the fall of 26 BCE. Oh, no, sorry, CE. 26 CE, of course. The BCE only applies before the Common Era, of course, before the birth of Christ, or a few years after the birth of Christ, because the BCE boundary between BCE and CE, Common Era, is only approximately around the time of Jesus' birth, seeing as it was set by somebody who lived hundreds of years after Jesus, and it was set incorrectly. In other words, the time when the Common Era began should have been the birth of Christ, and that should have been in 6, you know, at the time of the birth of Christ, 6 BCE, round about this time of year, very close to this time of year. In fact, he may well have been born on December 25th, it looks like. But that's possibly in the Julian calendar, though, not in our calendar today. The Gregorian calendar is not the same as the Julian calendar. It doesn't have the same, the date is different. it would have been, there was no Gregorian calendar before 1582 of our common era, you know, the year we would call 1582 was the first year of the Gregorian calendar, and that was established to correct for all the inaccuracies in the fact that a leap year is not accurate enough to keep the vernal equinox at the right time of the year, every year, so that it shifts over time. So the Gregorian calendar was introduced in 1582, but throughout the centuries, we can still use the Gregorian calendar back in the time of Jesus, but it would be a different date in the calendar. It would be a different date. So any date for Jesus' birth would have been in the Julian calendar, which was the time from Julius Caesar, his time, when that calendar was first established, up until 1582, in other words, 1,500 years and more after Julius Caesar, when the Gregorian calendar was instituted. And, the date of if we want to specify a certain date in time today, in the Julian calendar, it would not be December 24th today. We could look up what it is, but it's not December 24th in the Julian calendar. It's just December 24th in the Gregorian calendar. But at one point, if we go back far enough, there are times when there's very little difference between the two. The difference between the two varies over the centuries, let's put it that way. So if we go back far enough, they get closer together because the Gregorian preserves the equinox at the time of about March 22nd for the vernal equinox. And the Julian calendar was around March 22nd in the time of Julius Caesar for the vernal equinox. So if we go back to the time of Caesar, then the two are roughly the same. But anyway, Jesus was born in 6 BCE, but he was baptized when he was 30 years old in the year 26 CE, in other words, the Common Era. The Common Era, 26 of the Common Era, Jesus was baptized. And these events that are being talked about here are within 3.5 years after that, before Jesus was crucified in 30 of the Common Era. So at that particular time, Herod, the district ruler, heard the report about Jesus and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He was raised up from the dead. And this is why the powerful works are operating in him. For Herod had arrested John and bound him and put him away in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of Philip, his brother. For John had been saying to him, 'It is not lawful for you to be having her.' However, although he wanted to kill him, he feared the crowd, because they took him for a prophet. But when Herod's birthday was being celebrated, the daughter of Herodias danced at it and pleased Herod so much that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. Then she, under her mother's coaching, said, 'Give me here upon a platter the head of John the Baptist.' Grieved though he was, the king, out of regard for his oaths and for those reclining with him, commanded it to be given. And he sent and had John beheaded in the prison. And his head was brought on a platter and given to the maiden, and she brought it to her mother. Finally, his disciples came up and removed the corpse and buried him, and came and reported to Jesus. At hearing this, Jesus withdrew from there by boat into a lonely place for isolation, but the crowds, getting to hear of it, followed him on foot from the cities. Now when he came forth, he saw a great crowd, and he felt pity for them, and he cured their sick ones. But when evening fell, his disciples came to him and said, "The place is lonely, and the hour is already far advanced. Send the crowds away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves things to eat." However, Jesus said to them, "They do not have to leave. You give them something to eat." They said to him, "We have nothing here but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. He said, "Bring them here to me." Next, he commanded the crowds to recline on the grass and took the 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And looking up to heaven, he said a blessing. And after breaking the loaves, he distributed them to the disciples. The disciples in turn to the crowds. So all ate and were satisfied, and they took up the surplus of fragments, 12 baskets full. Yet those eating were about 5,000 men, besides women and young children. Then without delay, he compelled his disciples to board the boat and go ahead of him to the other side, while he sent the crowds away. Eventually, having sent the crowds away, he went up into the mountain by himself to pray. Though it became late, he was there alone. By now the boat was many hundreds of yards away from land, being hard put to it by the waves, because the wind was against them. But in the 4th watch period of the night, he came to them walking over the sea. When they caught sight of him walking on the sea, the disciples were troubled, saying, "It is an apparition," and they cried out in their fear. But at once Jesus spoke to them with the words, "Take courage, it is I. Have no fear." In reply, Peter said to him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you over the waters." He said, "Come." Thereupon, Peter, getting down off the boat, walked over the waters and went toward Jesus. But looking at the windstorm, he got afraid, and after starting to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, stretching out his hand, Jesus caught hold of him and said to him, "You with little faith, why did you give way to doubt?" And after they got up into the boat, the windstorm abated. Then those in the boat did obeisance to him, saying, "You are really God's son." And they got across and came to land in Gennesaret. Upon recognizing him, the men of that place sent forth into all that surrounding country, and people brought him all those who were ill. And they went entreating him that they might just touch the fringe of his outer garment, and all those who touched it were made completely well. So somebody who could heal the sick, somebody who could walk on water, and somebody who could calm the windstorm, but in this case it doesn't say he calmed the windstorm, but he walked on water. Would we doubt that he could multiply the loaves and fishes? Is there any doubt about that? If somebody who could heal the sick, walk on water, why could he not multiply the number of fish and loaves to feed 5,000 men when there were only 5 loaves and 2 fishes to begin with? Why would we doubt that when he could perform these other miracles? And yet, when Herod heard about him, he said, "This is John the Baptist, who was raised up from the dead." Herod didn't know who this was, this Jesus, this miracle worker that was causing a report to be spread about him because of the works Jesus was doing. There was a report circulating about him, apparently, from verse 1. So Herod heard the report about Jesus. He heard that Jesus was doing some wonderful things, some miracles. We know he was doing miracles because his disciples reported that. This was written by one of his disciples. Matthew wrote this book telling this truth about Jesus. It's not the only gospel. We have 3 other gospels, all of which tell the same story, that Jesus was a miracle worker, that he walked on water, or that he, if they don't give identical miracles in each one, although mostly they do, the book of John gives a few new or different things. as well, but they all give the same account that Jesus was a miracle worker. They all tell the same story. So they're not reports that need to be questioned. And just like with vitamin C, we know that other people say that vitamin C works. Merv Griffin used vitamin C every day. He took 4 grams of it, and he never got a cold or flu after that when he was working on his talk show. He was a TV host for a television talk show for many years. And he, at some point, was tired of being sick from these infections, and he learned about vitamin C, decided to try it. Because of him, I heard about it too. I heard about Merv Griffin around the very same time that I started taking vitamin C. I had learned about Merv Griffin, and I decided, well, if it worked for Merv Griffin, I must try it, because it's not just something that's reported by people I don't know or have never heard of. Merv Griffin I had heard of. I knew about Merv Griffin. I even watched his show. So I knew about Merv Griffin, and I knew that he had said that vitamin C prevented him from getting any colds or flus, and any infections, in other words. It prevented him from catching these seasonal infections. So ever since, but I didn't take it the way he did. I didn't take 4 grams a day. I just took it when I got sick, and then I took it rapidly at the onset of the illness before I got sick. That's how I took vitamin C. That's how I've taken it. And both work. Both methods work. If you want to be safer and not risk getting any of these very serious infections, which Dr. Cathcart has mentioned, they can be very serious. And if you don't take vitamin C very quickly, you can be in deep trouble and maybe die because you didn't take vitamin C quickly enough. So if you want to reduce that risk of getting one of these very serious infections, then you can take it every day if your body allows you to do it, which in most people, they can take, several thousand grams a day. I mean, milligrams, several thousand milligrams or several grams a day. If you can't take vitamin C, if you're allergic to it, then Dr. Cathcart explained in his one of his talks. Was it in one of his talks? Yeah, it was in that talk, that 26-minute talk by Dr. Cathcart. It's not on YouTube, but it's online somewhere. Or was it on YouTube? I'm trying to think. Maybe it was on YouTube, but I showed it in one of my one of my own videos recently. But I mean, the talk by Doctor, but he's given numerous talks about it. And if you can't take vitamin C, it means you've got some other infection, like a yeast infection or something, some other problem that prevents your body from tolerating vitamin C. Let's look up Dr. Cathcart in my history. Let's go to history. Look up Cathcart. This might be it here, is it?
The anti-yeast program, high doses of
vitamin C. It is on YouTube. It's on YouTube. It's called Dr. Robert Cathcart, Vitamin C Pioneer. It's 26 minutes and 8 seconds long. It's on the channel Dole V. Gilmore. Dolev Gilmore. Dolevgilmore. That channel has this video. It's a wonderful video, actually. But he has other videos. We'll have to cover them some other time, too. But he talks about how people with certain problems might not be able to take vitamin C, but it's fairly rare. It's rare that people can't take vitamin C. Once you cure these other infections, then you can take vitamin C, as a normal person would, and you can take several grams of it a day if you want to prevent these serious infections. It's very simple. If you take more than 4 grams a day, you might have diarrhea. So that's why the idea of taking 4 grams, it's pretty well, you take it to bowel tolerance, essentially. You can take it to bowel tolerance every day. Some people find they reach bowel tolerance at a smaller level or a greater number of grams or at a smaller number of grams. Some people can take 12 grams a day and not reach bowel tolerance, but I think for me it's somewhere around 6 maybe, or, and Dr. Cathcart believed that if you'd had infections when you were younger, the virus in your body would be causing these free radicals to destroy the vitamin C so you could take more before you reach biotolerance. That's how he explained it. But anyway, even by just, look at in verse 36 here, by just touching the outer garment of Jesus, they could be healed. They were healed by touching the outer garment of Jesus. It's amazing. So it's incredible. It's fantastic. It's beautiful. It's true, though. That's the thing. It is a true story. It's a true statement of the facts, the gospel accounts. That's why they're called gospel. They're true. But I was out shoveling today, and I should say a few words about that, I think. I just enjoyed it. The drifts of snow were about, in some places, about as much as a foot, you know, or you know, between 6 inches and 12 inches deep. I mean, there was some deep, but it was only about one third of the driveway that had the deep snow. And it wasn't all the way across the driveway either, I'd say. It was about halfway across the driveway and only one third of the length of the driveway. So it wasn't, I didn't have a lot, or, you know, actually, there was another deep spot over near the firewood. So I cleared a fair bit of snow, but it was very easy compared to the big storm we had a while back. But I wanted to talk about the tarps a little bit and talk about how hot it was. It was cold out there today, so I had to wear more clothing, and that risks getting sweaty. So I had a shell. I just needed to add a shell and another balaclava over top instead of wearing my just my scarf. My tube scarf. I had a balaclava and the tube scarf, and I also had my winter hat. And at one point I took the winter hat off when I got too warm, but then I had still that clothing on. And after I opened my shell, my precip jacket, which is a rain shell, it's just that helped me to stay cooler again. But I didn't open it. I didn't open it at first. I waited till I got hot and I needed to come in and use the restroom, and then when I came in, I left my jacket open when I went back out, so it kept me cooler and I didn't sweat very much. So I did sweat, though, and that's because it was about 6 or 7 below in Celsius temperature today, which was, it's about 6 degrees colder than what it was when I was wearing no shell. So the shell makes me a little too warm, but I can keep it open. So there are, but it's all, but I was very comfortable out there. I mean, I enjoy working when I'm comfortable. I didn't sweat too much when I was doing the last part of the shoveling with the jacket open. So I really enjoy that when I can just work and not worry about getting too sweaty. When I'm getting sweaty or when I'm getting cold, either of those two is not desirable. And it's not enjoyable to work under those conditions. But otherwise, I love working on anything. You know, it's physical workout. This is the only place in the world, it occurred to me, this is the only place, the only type of climate in the world where you can get a workout and not sweat. And that I love about it. I absolutely love that about it. It's fantastic. It's just, you know, exquisite to be able to work hard and not sweat. And you can do that because of the temperature and because of dressing exactly correctly in terms of how much clothing and how many layers, what type of clothing, everything about how you dress will determine whether you can work out without sweating. And there's a lot to learn about that. It's an enormous thing. And now the tarpaulins, one of them, it keeps getting pulled away. The wire keeps getting pulled away from the bolt that I put in the wall. But that's good because the wind is so strong. If that wire didn't rip off and pull away from that lag bolt, if it didn't disconnect so the tarp could blow freely, it would rip the grommets out of the tarp, or it would rip the tarp into shreds because it's really strong wind out there, really strong. And the other rope that holds the corner of the front tarp that is my garage door, only one corner of that tarp is normally fastened, but that corner that was fastened broke. The rope broke, which is a very thin rope, and it was an older piece of polyester rope, I believe, some kind of rope, which is ultraviolet resistant, but it was getting older and frayed. It was a little bit worn, and that rope broke, but I didn't try to fix it because the wind is blowing the canvas so hard that if I tried to tie that down, it would damage, well, I believe, it would risk damaging the canvas. That's the problem. So I'm going to let it blow freely in the wind. I'll tie it again when the wind is quiet, you know, and I'll try to come up with, maybe it should be tied with a bungee cord. I just realized that's what it should be tied with. I'm gonna tie these things with bungee cords maybe, and then they can be blown by the wind, and they'll still come back when there's no wind. But I got a lot of snow on my van too, because the tarp was blown free. That tarp didn't protect, because the tarp on the west side, which was newly installed the other day when I damaged my thumb, that tarp blew free, and all the snow got onto my van. So I had, you know, several inches of snow on my van, on the tarp, on top of the van. It's covered with a tarp, so I had to get all the snow off the van while I was out there as well. And that I didn't have to do during that heavy storm, because there was nothing on the van during that storm, because there was no wind. So sometimes we do get wind with a lot of snow, but it's not very common. There wasn't much snow. It was drifting, a lot of drifting. Only a few inches of snow, but that's all for today's study. I'm tired a little bit here from the outdoor work, and I'm going to eat. I haven't had any vitamin K2 today, but I've had my potato chips for my breakfast. I broke my fast. I don't fast the same amount. I don't believe in fasting the same way that Lauren Lachman does, but I know that what he's saying is correct. For the most part, what he says is true. It's just, at least much of it is true. It's just that you can't fast unless your body is really conditioned to fast. And he's conditioned his body to fast over many, many years. And he teaches other people how to fast. He helps other people fast. But that doesn't mean that anybody can just fast the first time they try. They might fail. You might fail the first day you try, the first two days. You might go one day and then you need to eat. But then if you try again the next day, you might succeed in fasting for longer. It requires practice, and it requires conditioning of the body, which are basically the same thing, but may not be identical in terms of what those two things are. But still, I mean, fasting is good for healing, so I wanted to fast because I'm trying to heal my thumb. But I'm not going to eat quite, I won't be eating quite as much as I would normally be eating, I think, because I want to relax, take it easy. Not when I work hard, like I went out and worked today, I have to eat, because, or either that or I'll burn a lot of fat, but I'll be very, very tired if I don't eat. You know, I'll be, it'll be harder. I can hydrate, certainly. I just haven't learned. I haven't practiced fasting to the same extent that some other people like Lauren Lachman have. So I'm saying it's worth considering, though, as a therapy for many illnesses. And also, Dr. Jamnadas, talking about cancer. Let's talk about cancer. Dr. Jamnadas says that cancer is really kind of the last of a series. Cancer is the last stage of the basic disease that everyone gets. Starts with diabetes, leads to heart disease, eventually cancer. Those are all the same disease. It's all just one disease. Right? Diabetes, it's all caused by overeating. So fasting is something that Dr. Jamnadas teaches for that reason, that it cures those diseases. Those are not infections. Although cancer is is an infection of some kind. So you can treat cancer with vitamin C. And I've still not tried treating hay fever with vitamin C. I've got to try that. It's a great idea because Dr. Cathcart, that was how he discovered vitamin C. He discovered its power in the treatment of all infections. All infections. Hepatitis is cured by vitamin C. All of these, I can't tell you all the things. I can't tell you enough to make you aware of how revolutionary it is, vitamin C, how completely mind-boggling the power of vitamin C is. But, I mean, hepatitis, mononucleosis, I can't name all the diseases, any infection, all the flus, all the coronavirus, all the, all colds, in other words, everything, strep throat, tonsillitis, mumps, measles, polio, any infection is cured with vitamin C. That's the reality because infections always do the same thing. They always create these free radicals. They always have that pattern, and therefore if you can eliminate the free radicals, you kill the virus. Or the bacteria. It works for bacterial infections too. You don't need antibiotics at all, ever. That's the lesson. That's the fact. You never need antibiotics, ever. Okay, so I've said enough. It is Ward Green. The time is... Let me bring this over here. The time is, December 24th. It's 1915 now. A few seconds ago, it was 1914 hours. But it's December 24th, 2022. I wish you a wonderful day, every single day, not just today. But today, whatever you're doing, I hope the remainder of your day is a beautiful experience and that you are continuing to rejoice every day. That let's praise little children. Let's praise Jehovah for all the good things he brings to us. And rejoice in tribulation, too, as the book of James puts it. But rejoice and praise Jehovah. And may God bless you. May you have a wonderful remainder of your day. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. I love you. Bye for now.